This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about The Deer Hunter, released in 1978 and starring Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, John Cazale, John Savage, Meryl Streep, and many, many other character actors. This movie was directed by Michael Cimino. It was distributed by Universal Pictures and EMI Films. This movie has a running time of 184 minutes. It was made for a budget of $15 million and it raked at the box office on release $49 million. How are you guys?
I am super well. How are you?
I'm all right.
And I'm also very well.
Mm. That's good. That's good. We are young. We run green. We run tea. Nice and clean.
See our friends. See the skies. Feel all right. In this week's episode, we are talking about a movie picked by Ricky.
I believe it was.
Yes. Why did you pick this movie, Ricky?
Because I just got the 4K release of it about a month or two ago. And I do love this film so much.
This is all about friendship. It's all about friends getting married, going to war, pretty much the same thing. And Steve.
Yeah, I'm getting married in 10 days. Yeah.
You are.
And my name's Stevie, or Steve.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm kind of screwed. I've got to lose both legs. And
we changed Nikki to Ricky several times throughout this movie. But a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what's this movie about?
How do you get out of a marriage, go to war in Vietnam, and lose your two legs and an arm?
Oh, shit. Holy shit. Socks
and maybe, maybe you shoot a deer.
That's pretty much how he... Hey, I don't even remember sleeping with my wife to get this baby, but you know what? I'll go to Vietnam. Okay, let me try that one again. This film is about the horrors of war and how the good old boys can all be turned into the sad old boys by the time they get into war.
Yeah. Now, was I the only one thrown off by the fact that we have 35-something playing 20-year-olds and acting very well like 20-year-olds, all of them?
This was a
big controversial thing about this movie, you know that, right?
It was a different time. People looked older.
It was a different time, you see?
I don't think I really cared because they were all Bolshevik Russian Orthodox Christians. So you tell me a young Bolshevik vodka-drinking Russian Orthodox Christian.
We all have Polish friends or Eastern European friends and the most dangerous man on the planet. But this movie is about friendship. It really is. It got me in the fields yesterday a little bit. And also, prior to watching this movie, we all talked to each other. And, you know, like I kept saying, look, I guess our experience mirrors, it kind of mirrored like yours and yours. Like when we talked about it, we all tried to watch this. It took repeated viewings when we were younger. It's not even the pacing, but I think you need to, it's a very adult film, as in, yeah, the themes are, you need to have lived a little to get it. And I was convinced that I had it this time before watching it, because I was questioning that wedding scene and why it's so extended and why this movie opens with people going to work, where they live. It's Cimino is trying to get you in a very organic way to make a connection with these people. As a viewer, you're invited to the wedding. And who's invited to a wedding? It's an intimate thing, right? So you're going to be close to be invited to a wedding.
Yeah, like you. Best man.
So,
hey.
Thank you. Yeah. One of the lucky ones. But I hope the food is good, Steve. The food is good.
Hey, punk. I've been slaving all day making that slop.
The food is good.
Fucking it is.
Otherwise, he'll be standing at the door just like those two were, like, forcing people to give him money. You know, like, oh, do the happy bread, have a couple, come on, you give it down, and then you get it in.
In our intro, which we just said, and many other character actors, but there are, and one of them kept nagging at me because, like, we watch this guy act in 1,000 movies, and yet I can't place him anywhere. I can't pronounce his name correctly. So is it George? Oh, my God, I can't.
George DeJuzenke? DeJuzenke?
There's got to be a way to pronounce his name
correctly.
He's a portly kind of guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, basic instinct.
George Zuntza? Oh, man, he's got, as a, you know, like, he's a supporting, he's a supporting, fucking hell, stop it. Right, I'm cutting in here in post. I'm editing the show, and I just got to the point in which we keep stumbling over this character actor's name. His name is George Zunda. It's pronounced Zunda. Why am I doing this? Because this guy has peppered so many movies that we grew up with. I'm talking Crimson Tide, Basic Instinct, Dangerous Minds, Deer Hunter. He was in Law & Order episodes. He was in 10,000 things. So credit goes to you, Mr. Zunda. His name is pronounced George Zunda. He's a supporting actor in this, but he does have, there's a lot of endearing moments. And also, it's quite centric. He's always in a good scene because he owns the bar. He's the one that is continuously providing the scene that you just described of him and the other guy that basically, you know, every line has a fucking A in it because that's the core of his dialogue.
Oh, man. Do you know the story about Chuck Aspergen?
Wow.
It was his first role.
The guy
role.
That says fucking A every time.
It was his first role. And he was a foreman at the steel mill.
Oh, okay.
But when they were doing the wrecking for the film, they quite literally got on with this guy. He was the second guy hired for the movie.
Yeah, you know the guy that invented the Segway went off a fucking cliff. You know that, right? Now, for our listeners, where do you go and watch the Deer Hunter? We were raving. Well, I was raving about this. If you have an Amazon Prime subscription, you may know already that every once in a while you get offered like a 7-day trial for add-on channels. And they all operate in the same way, you know, like you're given a decent transfer usually, but you're still mainly streaming stuff at 1080p when it's been released in 4K. I got to say the Studio Canal's approach here is fantastic because companies like Criterion as well doesn't like to stream like a 4K HDR, it doesn't like to stream their content in 4K HDR if they are releasing a physical counterpart of the whatever movie we're talking about here, because they want to sell physical copies. But Studio Canal will go out of their way to release the same transfer available in physical media. So if you haven't used your 7-day trial for Studio Canal, please do. We're not sponsored by Amazon in any way, shape, or form. We should be.
Or Studio Canal.
But in this instance, it's one of those trials that actually I stayed on for. There's a lot of good stuff in there. There's most of Carpenter's catalog is in there now. And, you know, the streams are pretty good. So as much as I am a supporter of physical media, there's no excuse here. If you need to watch The Deer Hunter, and if you remember it to be a movie that was too long, yes, it is a long movie, but it paces furiously, believe it or not. Even I thought it was poorly paced. It's not. It really isn't. Plus, now you have this dialogue boost function on Amazon as well that is implemented, you know, on content that allows it. And this movie actually benefits from that because we used it yesterday. I'm not going to say it's a revelation, but I'm kind of pleased because I was postponing this viewing. Myself and Steve were scheduled to watch this movie last week and we just kept, you know, procrastinating. But then we got around to watching it. I mean, it's already a long movie, but I stopped it several times. So it was a 6-hour movie yesterday. But it wasn't unpleasant. Like, it was, It made me feel quite a bit, you know. It's not the first time that we see De Niro act in anguish, but fuck, man, you're there. Don't do this to me. Fucking. Mm. Oh, man. I was about to shed a tear yesterday. Right.
There is a lot of different actors within this. I mean, you've already spoken about a lot of character actors. But let's focus on one particular actor in this who enters the film and comes back towards the end of the film. And the sad story of John Cazale around this film. We mentioned, well, I mentioned in our podcast about The Conversation about the demise of John Cazale, and I only touched on it, but this is his last film. And not only was this his last film, but he was in the throes of lung cancer throughout this film to such an extent that he must have been stage 3 at least, minimum, if not stage 4, because the studios weren't going to pay for his insurance to be on this film. He had to be, he was dating Meryl Streep at the time. Not only was she assisting him and on set with him every time he had a scene to do because of how weak he was, but Robert De Niro gave up part of his salary to pay for the insurance so that they could keep John Cazale on the film. And even the director was given an ultimatum at one point saying, could you rewrite the script in case John dies, or maybe we should just not have him? And he basically said, if we're not having him, I'm not on this picture. And he did write a really bad mock-up of the script without John Cazale's character of Stan. But every scene John is in is blinding. He gives 110%. And when you know how much he was dealing with in terms of how weak he was on his feet or just dealing with lines he had to learn, there's a completely savage scene at the wedding where he punches a woman in the face.
And it comes from nowhere because you think he's going to hit the guy. Yeah. You think he's going to hit the guy, so it really throws you, man.
But the fact that you have a character, and the best thing about this film is that the character arcs, there are several character arcs. There's not just the three boys who go to Vietnam's character arcs. Every single character in this has some sort of arc. His character arc becomes even more palatable when you see him again after the Vietnam scenes. He was a fantastic actor. Every film he was in, he was blinding. My favorite film with him in is Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, that's
and
an amazing
Steve, when did Dog Day Afternoon come out?
1975.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny how there's DNA shared between, you know, like you could argue that in the 70s there was this kind of frenemy relationship between De Niro and Pacino, both method actors, you know what I mean? And Cazale straddled that line of working with both of them in The Godfather as well. I don't even know if there's any movies where he was leading. He's a fantastic actor.
He's a supporting actor, but one of the best supporting actors of his time. If you just think about it, every single one of his movies that he was in was basically nominated for an Oscar. So you're looking at Deer Hunter, Godfather Part Two, Dog Day Afternoon. Conversation, definitely.
Look, he's the reactive agent in like really powerful explosives. Yeah. He's the secret ingredient in an elixir. You know, like he's always been part of something that left a mark, and not just in a marginal way. Like he's memorable every fucking time. So he's the embodiment of a good supporting actor. You know, and acting is reacting. So you could argue that, you know, he's always been leading man material, but, you know, stealthily showing up as a supporting actor. And it's unbelievable. You mentioned Dog Day Afternoon. That movie wouldn't be what it is. Or the emotional punch that some of the sequences in that movie pack is due to his performance more than Pacino. Simply because Pacino is kind of on, you know, is in one gear all the way through the movie. And Cazale switches gears all the way through the movie. So we see him. He's the one on the roller coaster more than Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon. But anyway, we'll have to do that movie at some point because it's a very important movie for several reasons. But they are akin to one another because here there's an examination of friendships, male friendships, that is almost revisionistic. The relationships between men in American culture didn't go this deep before this movie, I think. It's a different kind of animal. All of this went right over my head as a teenager. Right over my head.
A lot of us would be had the same experience with this as a teenager. I mean, like, I remember watching this movie back in the 90s. And, like, I just kind of saw it as a like, even from remembrance, I remembered it as a Vietnam War movie. When we were watching it yesterday, I didn't remember the Steelworks part. So for me, it feels like I could remember Wedding, but I couldn't remember the bits. So obviously my memory is faulty. Needs probably a reboot.
I saw myself as, you know, it's not egomania here, but I like, there's some character traits that you were showing in this movie. I saw myself in De Niro, and that's not a good thing at all, a couple of times, as an archetype. And he's a quite idealistic character in this, almost like to a torturous level, which is not a good thing, you know. He's the most conflicted character here. You may think that it's Walken is the one, but not really. He's the one that is riddled with guilt. He's the one that is... that somehow is holding on to an ideal, and he's the one that feels like he's continuously misunderstood. So he's the one carrying the burden in this group of friends, more than any.
He's the loner on the style kind of person or personality. And I know when I was researching this that De Niro went off and basically would segregate himself from the rest of the team. While filming and various other bits and pieces to keep that persona. But he's also one of the key elements. So when you think about it, when Walken's character basically turns around and says, "Oh, you know, I want to be buried at home.
Don't leave me there. Don't leave me there." Yeah. About De Niro, I mean, I think one of the most, and looking back, you know, now we're looking back, it's a fresh watch. We watched this yesterday, but further realization that I didn't have yesterday of how important the sequence of him in the taxi picking up on the fact that there's a welcome home party and just going by, that's a powerful sequence because we've all been there at some point. We've all been in a state of mind so... distressing that we sought isolation at a time in which, you know, it would be, you know, out of step because it's, you know, that's what happens, right? That's, you would want to rekindle with the family, the friends in your life or whatever. That moment, that hit hard because there have been times in which, you know, you couldn't handle a feeling that you couldn't even pinpoint and you wanted to retreat.
Yeah,
not knowing why. And that's exactly what that scene is. Like, he's in a state of confusion when he gets back, almost. It's a heavy movie, but there are some... I mean, I picked up on some humor because that's what I'm saying. I see myself in De Niro in a couple of sequences in this movie. It's when John Cazale... I mean, that's 100% comedy. When they meet again the following day after he doesn't show up for his own party, Cazale... you know, wants some kind of acknowledgement, and he goes, "Hey, man, I grew a mustache. Can you see it?" And it's the nearest reaction to that. It's like, yeah, I can see it. Like, it's very nuanced, but it's one of the funniest sequences in this movie to me.
Yeah, but I think with on my watching of this, revisiting the history of what John Cazale was going through. In me, I actually saw the real Robert De Niro talking to John Cazale. You know, that sort of like, there's a slight recognition of, we've got you here, John, and you're on film, you know. There's a, I think, a same sort of thing. It's really powerful scene about friendships and about reconnecting and keeping those bonds as solid as possible. But I think looking through the behind the scenes and all that stuff, it looked more like Robert De Niro just being so thankful that John's able to make the shoot, or, you know, that he can actually stand up for that scene. But you know what? Let's go back. Let's go back to the start of this film, the wedding. The thing that turns a lot of people off this film very quickly, because they get to about 20 minutes into the wedding scene and they're like, what is this? There's, on the front cover, it's got Robert De Niro with a gun to his head. And what is, why 20 minutes of these people just getting drunk? And what is this? You know, so what was your first experience with this film? You've brought up little tidbits and whatnot of when you were younger, you started watching this film and you're like, what am I? Why? So what was your first recollection of the wedding scene?
One of my first recollections of a scene. It's one of the standouts. It's one of the parts I remember truly from the night when I watched this movie on VHS in the 90s. Because it was chaotic. It was full. It showed these teenagers, technically, going off to war. It showed them with the happiness, and it felt slapdash at the time, but I revisiting it now, it feels it's needed to set those characters and set the story.
Do you remember when you watched the first time?
My god, 1991 maybe. Yeah,
do you got it on video? Was it on TV? Or
it was on VHS.
Okay.
And I mean, it must have been around Christmas time. I can remember it being like cold.
But did you pick the movie, or somebody else was watching it?
I think it was Chris, who is ever so much popped up on this conversation multiple times. I think it's Chris Wheel.
Okay. We're going to have this guy on the show at some point, you know.
Yeah.
Chris, we Screen Divers are extending an invitation on behalf of your friend Steve, who could have just called you. Come on the show. I mean, come on the show.
I would just basically say we'd have to do a Van Damme movie.
That's fine.
Yeah, something.
Whatever it takes.
Kickboxer or something, you know.
My experience with this movie... I know for a fact that, and then we'll reconnect to why, what happened yesterday. It was so poignant that we called you. I called you, Ricky, in one of the several bouts of procrastination yesterday that extended the viewing time for us. I even called you because
3 hours.
At one point I said to Steve, you know what, this reminds me of the sequence that, you know, like, I think it was the third act. It's somewhere in the third act. It's a really dark sequence. It's De Niro just pacing the streets looking for Nick. Nick? Yeah?
Yeah, Nick.
And, you know, it's a city street. Everything looks wet and dark, and there's fires here and there peppered throughout every shot. And it's one man just looking for his friend in the shadows. Like, it's, and it, from a visual standpoint, it reminded me of something I've seen before. And it also reminded me of something that was pretty much permeating every single movie my stepfather would like. Fulvio, shout out to you if you're listening to this. But the idea is, I said to Steve, man, this reminds me of a movie. What was it called? The Year of the Dragon. You remember The Year of the Dragon with Mickey Rourke? And he goes, yeah, it's like... It was a time. I think it was between 86 and 89 that every movie looked like fucking Black Rain. You know what I mean? Every crime movie looked like Black Rain. It was a man on a mission that breaks the rules. And, you know, it was that thing. It was a short period. And Mickey Rourke kind of was a part of his career that really had those roles. You know what I mean? Going against the grain on his own. And at one point I said, yeah, guess what? Even that movie was directed by Cimino. So it is a visual style. It will get to a point in the third act of his movies where you get these sequences. I don't know what it is. It's like there's nothing left and the protagonist is searching or seeking something.
Through an almost apocalyptic landscape, yeah.
Exactly. He does this every single time. Now, I remember that was the flavor that permeated every single one of the movies that my stepfather used to like. And I used to sit with him and watch them as well. But I was too young, because all these movies are really adult, proper adult themes. It wasn't even the violence. But it was, you know, you need to be, you know, a formed adult to get some of these themes. And yeah, it washed over me. To me, they were boring at one point. Mm. You know, there were action sequences in this, but that's not... That wasn't the height of every single one of these movies. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't. And I'll give you an example. It's like there's even Angel Heart, for example, which wasn't Cimino, but the idea has the same flavor. It has the same flavor. And again, another running thread here is Mickey Rourke. I think that was a thing in his career. But so I watched it because somebody else was watching it. And I didn't keep watching because I watched this movie like from beginning to end. But I think it became like a ritual, a bonding ritual with my stepfather. I hate that term, but, you know, he did his best. You know, like it, and that was a thing that we bonded over. But I was just there. You know, I found him boring, but I was close to him. That was the only way to bond over something, really. I'm going to go out of my way to try and, because now we have a different relationship, you know. Like he stepped into my life when I was like post puberty, like teenager, rebellious. So I made his fucking life really difficult, to be honest. He was trying to be a father and I made his life a nightmare. But this is one of the movies that I have memories of being shared with him. So I didn't pick it, you know, just like this time I didn't pick it.
So with me, I definitely watched this a lot later on. Like it must have been early 2000s, maybe late 90s, but I think it's early 2000s. So I would have already seen Casualties of War. I would have already seen Apocalypse Now. There may have been a few other ones. Like I definitely had seen Platoon by then. So this was like one of those, oh, it's a Vietnam film and I haven't seen it. I've seen all these other Vietnam films. I'm going to watch this one.
It's funny, you mentioned Stone. You mentioned Platoon. Yeah. I know this, not because I know this, but just that my eye just fell over the, you know, all the credits on IMDb. And the movie that we mentioned earlier, Year of the Dragon, it was co-written by Oliver Stone. So Cimino and Stone worked together quite extensively.
Yeah. So I actually watched this quite late on. And I watched this with the knowledge of Vietnam films are harrowing and they're depressing.
Do you remember how old you were?
Let's say it's either 16 or 17. Maybe
at that stage, like, you know, scratch my ass, smell my finger kind of thing.
No, more of I absolutely love Apocalypse Now. I absolutely love Platoon. So I'm going to love any other Vietnam film because most Vietnam films are about the depressing end of Vietnam, not the even
not the fun, not the
Green Beret by with John Wayne, but even Born on the 4th of July has that. Yeah, you know.
I'm listening to you, but my eye just fell on something. There's a just type in Michael Cimino on Google.
Are we going to Wiki Feet?
No. Michael Cimino's feet. later. We'll do this later. Just type in Michael Cimino. You should be getting like a photo of him holding a cigarette with Ray-Bans or aviators or something.
Yeah.
Is it the photo you're getting?
Yeah.
Now, tell me if this isn't bang on. It looks like a fusion of Dustin Hoffman and Bruno Kirby.
I would say he looks like he's ready to make his own cult, move to Africa, and everybody drink the Kool-Aid.
Oh, he looks like, my God. He looks like Jim Jones as well, dude. Holy shit.
Jim Jones.
Oh, my God.
Do you want to have some Kool-Aid?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shit. Different ways to get cancelled.
Let's not break through that wall.
Well, maybe somebody should have broken through that wall, Steve. Somebody should have.
Let's be cordial to one another.
My goodness. With the wedding scene, what I love about the wedding scene is just how joyous it is. It's a mess. It's joyous. It's rambunctious. And there's so much dancing. Christopher Walken's career as a dancer is proven throughout this. And then you get that little scene with the Green Beret officer who comes in for a drink.
Oh, shit, yeah.
And you get the fuck it. Hell. You just
Who is that guy, by the way?
That I don't know. It was one person I didn't look up, but his performance was amazing.
When he came on screen, and then I immediately, as I'm saying it, I said to Steve, like, it was so misplaced because he would have been much, much older. But he reminded me of, I cannot fucking pronounce his name, of a younger Ernest Borgnine. He was a taxi driver in Escape from New York. He was, how do you pronounce his name?
Ernest Borgnine. Yeah.
Sorry.
Isn't it Ernest Borgnine? Oh, you've
okay,
made
so I'm
sick.
Not alone here. It's fine.
I had it. Ernest Borgnine.
Can we all try? Can we all ever go? Ernest Borgnine? Steve?
Ernest Borgnine.
Borgnine. This isn't fucking TNG, mate.
Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
So the actor who played that Green Beret guy was Paul D'Amato, or D'Amato.
Let me step in with the Italian.
Let me just do with my hand.
Why does it look like you're
jerking off? With my hand.
It's not this.
It's just a little finger out as well.
Hey, thumb in this finger. Middle finger like this. Point it towards you.
Okay.
Look at that, man. You're making a mozzarella with your mouth.
That's not where mozzarella starts from. God.
Would you like some burrata?
So he was used for Heaven Can Wait. He was used for Heaven's Gate. He was used for FX. But again, he was
FX with fucking Brian Dennehy and Australian actor. What's his name?
Is the Australian actor's name is, and I'm slowing down to bring it up. Brian Brown.
Brian Brown and Brian Dennehy.
But he's never been a full
Brian Dennehy, right?
Yeah,
Brian Dennehy.
It is. It is.
Sure.
Yes, but I am talking about Paul D'Amato.
Anyway, go on. Sounds like a singer. Was he a singer? Paul D'Amato.
Diano was a
Paul
singer.
D'Amato, American. Paul D'Amato. You know, the first photo that pops up, it's that role.
It's a Green Beret. Yeah.
Oh, anyway. Shit. He died last year.
Yes. He just died last year. So we killed him off.
What a face that guy's got, man. The features, like really strong features.
So that scene is incredible because out of all of this joyous moment, the boys are still joyous, but their Cassandra walks into the wedding. Their Oracle walks into the wedding and they ask him the question, what is it like over there? And all he can say is, fuck it.
Oh, he's and got 1,000 yards there, right?
Yeah, and he... Yeah. And they even get really, like, uptight about it. Like, Robert De Niro is about to throw punches.
He turns. Robert De Niro turns into that guy. That's the very thing. Like, there's so... Look, I don't even, there's so many things, nothing is just superfluous here. I thought this movie was, that's why, you know, the very definition that I may have formed for myself, and come on, this must mirror the way you guys, not you, Ricky, because you picked this up later, I think. I think the experience that I had, it's possibly similar to Steve's experience as well, which is we just didn't, because we didn't seek it, and we were young as well, there was no way to connect. There was no way to connect with this film. But the idea is, once you start paying attention, everything that seems like filler is not. Like, the poignancy of him at the beginning just saying, being so adamant about how important it is to use one bullet when you hunt. And, you know, we know this about hunting, that there is some kind of, you know, moral ground that a proper hunter would take, because you have to, technically, otherwise you're just a piece of shit. You know, to make it fair, it's not fair, but to make it fair, it's like one shot, or you, and if you fail, you go home kind of thing. So he had this strong kind of ideal. So that's why I said he's a very idealistic character, right? And if it, you could see the frustration that he was exuding every single time. He wouldn't connect with his friends over something that, you know, he even says to Nick, he says, I can't go hunting with them. You know, if it wasn't for you, and you never heard that kind of genuine kind of, cards are on the table with two men talking about, and there's nothing sexual about it, but it is a feelings, and they talk about it openly. You didn't see that on screen before. You know, that's like praising the friendship. And men really didn't, this is an environment in which you have blue collar, you know, background. So you could say that this is the revisionism in this movie. These people didn't talk about their fucking feelings, man. In real life. So there's as much as it seems like it's a very dark and depressing film, there's a lot of hope in it. There's a lot of hope, you know.
Did you spot Robert De Niro's Merkin?
Robert De Niro?
Merkin, when he was running naked in the streets.
Oh, yeah.
Dick out. Yeah. No. It was a Merkin, for sure. Like,
a Merkin?
A merkin is when you put on a G-string sort of thing, and it's basically looks like pubic bush, and hence hiding your...
You look like a real dick.
I look like a merkin to me, especially when he was lying down flat, and Christopher Walken...
But what is a merkin? Is it like a...
It's a little cover.
It's just a cover-up of pubic hair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Instead of like a gym sock, they use a merkin.
We are not going to re-examine frame by frame. Like,
You would have yesterday. I thought, like, all that pausing, you would have noticed if it was a merkin or a real dick.
There
you
is
say
no
it's a real
way
dick.
That I'm not doing that later, and there's no way that Anne won't enter this room as I am doing that. And my first fucking defense would be to use you as a human shield here, going, Ricky asked me to do this.
I needed to see the merkin.
Use you as a human shield.
I also, you know, we've talked a lot about the wedding scene. I love that deer hunting scene. I love the realness, the truth of having a bunch of guys driving up a mountain and just being assholes with them. It's such a male thing, and it's such a...
It is, but it's being lost, you know, like... I actually see like a early millennial looking at that sequence with some kind of nostalgia that comes not from, like, it's like the long, you know, wanting an experience like that. And you know that the generation does, actually. They really want it. They want it. I think the sadness comes from, but not the next one. The younger ones have no desire for that whatsoever. But that's why I'm thinking millennials are tormented, dude. They are, because depending where you fall, if you're closer to Xennials and you got a taste. So it kind of, I told you, like, we're lucky, right?
Look, how many of us have done that kind of weird cross-country road trip?
Oh, fishing. Everything like that. Yeah. Took mushrooms. One of us almost died. That kind of thing.
Exactly,
yeah.
Or even intercontinentally, like, you know.
Intercontinentally. You say it three times real fast.
Intercontinentally.
Yeah.
So the thing I loved about that scene was actually one of the early parts of it where they left George Dezendra, I want to call him.
I'm just going to say 36 cans. 36 cans.
Let him finish.
But when he thinks they've driven away, yeah, and he's like, he has that look on his face like, oh God, what do I do now? Do I follow them? And then he notices them reversing, so he sets himself up to be like, I knew you'd come back and all that stuff. That's the sort of male camaraderie.
But it also sets up a punchline that it's again later.
Yeah.
Because it's a very dramatic kind of end to the movie. There is a sadness that it's covering the third act of this movie. And all of a sudden, just like in the background, you see him chase the car. And it's funny because you got a taste of it earlier. And this movie does this quite often, by the way. You know, like we were talking about, sorry, to go back to the point I was trying to make earlier, which is the idealistic nature of De Niro's archetype. At the beginning, and his friends are kind of irritated. There's one exchange that reminded me of an exchange between Woody Harrelson and McCartney in the only decent, well, not the only decent season, but the best season of what's it called?
True Detective,
in which the chemistry between those two guys was amazing. I actually, after this, at least I'm going to go rewatch a couple of episodes. But there's a lot of comedy, you know, just because you see the irritation mounting on Harrelson's character. And there's a similar sequence in this. I can't remember which one of the in the group of friends says that to him, but they kind of don't even, they don't irritate it, but it's like, ugh, he's starting again with this, you know, like, and Harrelson at one point is disgruntled to the point which it's just, can you just say one normal thing?
This place is like somebody's memory of a town and the memory's fading. It's like there was never anything here but jungle.
Stop saying shit like that. It's unprofessional.
Oh, is that what I'm going for here?
Just want you to stop saying odd shit like you smell a psychosphere or you're in someone's faded memory of a town. Just stop.
It builds their friendship, right? It really builds their friendship. But in this instance, like in this movie, the phrase that really was going to be poignant on so many different, at a literal level almost, when he goes, the bullet is, do you remember what it says? It is what the bullet is, or...
You gotta learn, Stanley. Every time you come up here, you got your goddamn head up your ass.
Maybe he likes the view from up there, huh?
Every time he comes up, he's got no knife, he's got no jacket, he's got no pants, he's got no boots. Oh, he's got that stupid gun he carries around like John Wayne. That ain't gonna help you.
Oh, what the hell, Mike? Give him the boots.
No way. I ain't giving him no boots. No more. No more. That's it.
You're a fucking bastard. You know that?
Huh? Stanley, see this? This is this. This ain't something else. This is this. From now on your own.
And it's the fucking, at the core of the movie. It's the Russian roulette thing. It's the bullet, the one bullet. Like, it is what it is.
You have to think about one shot. One shot is what it's all about. A deer's got to be taken in one shot.
The hunting sequence. The first time, because there's two hunting sequences in this, just like there are two Russian roulette sequences, and the moment we see the first one, I thought that was the end of the movie, like completely misplaced it in my head. That's a memory that I have, how easy it is. But in that hunting sequence, you see there's a moment in which you see the anguish in this animal dying, which is bizarre thing to show, right? But I read that they didn't kill the animal, but that reaction you get out of the deer is a tranquilizing dart.
Yeah.
So it's basically seeing through time. It's having its own like little personal trip.
Yeah, but the deer looks like it's fucking tripping out.
Yeah,
right? Like,
yeah, like, hardcore. Oh, okay,
deer's on ketamine. That's exactly... what it is, right? The tranquilizer is
Because supposedly the tranquilizer didn't work properly. Like, they thought, oh, we'll give it a tranquilizer and we'll just film it. It ended up that they gave it a tranquilizer and had to film it for close to 40 minutes with two different cameras just to finally see it.
This deer got hit with ketamine several times.
Oh, it's crazy. Because, like, it's proper wide-eyed open. Yeah, like, I'm going down, everyone. Oh, just wait for it. It's going to... Oh, I'm on the ground. I'm here.
Grown like a star, my vast sleep. I opened my eyes to take a peek, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Just then, when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Then, when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love.
Did anybody find the sponsorship really annoying about this film? This was one of my negatives. The sponsorship.
Stop. Let us guess. Is it a brand?
Mm-hmm. I'm actually really surprised.
Red Rock.
Yes. Not red. Red. Rock. Not red.
Rock. Blue Rock.
Rolling Rock. Yeah. But yeah, throughout the wedding scene, throughout the bar scenes, even when they're drinking hard liquor, you can see Rolling Rock in almost every shot in America.
Why do you have a problem with this?
It was just, for some reason, it really popped up. And then Michael at the bar goes, what kind of beer would you like? And okay, I'll get you a Rolling Rock. They even verbalized it. Like, it's the only beer we can talk about, all right? Is it Rolling Rock?
While every brewer knows that nothing protects the flavor of pure, natural beer like darkness, very few do anything about it. This is one of the few. We protect Rolling Rock in light, tight six-packs because we brew Rolling Rock with all natural ingredients. Mountain spring water, no additives, no preservatives. Rolling Rock premium beer, so pure and natural, before you open a bottle, you have to open the box.
There was a moment in which they're having, I don't know, they're convening over something. It's the back room at the bar. It's the equivalent of the office at the Bada Bing in The Sopranos, right? And there's a table right in the middle of the scene. And on the table, there's, immediately I said this to Steve, there's on the table, it's like, you know those, oh my God, in painting, there's an entire, oh fuck, what's it called, the style? It's like dying fruit or whatever. There's a, what's it called?
Oh,
what's it called?
Still life.
Still life, yeah.
Yeah.
And immediately, as soon as, because it's so centric to the scene, it's in the middle, it's on the table. Yet again, it's in the background, but it stood out to me. There's a cabbage, a carrot, some celery, what it's obviously vodka, and some kind of whitefish. And I just said to Steve, Russian food. And somehow it looked appealing in that scenario.
But it's,
if
it's,
you, no, it is. If I'm good, it did. You know, if I'm gonna put a glass up and I need to say Nazdrovia at the end of that exchange, you know, it's Eastern European food. I want fucking fermented vegetables of some kind. I want vodka that burns your insides. You know, mislabeled, say palinka, mislabeled alcohol. Am I gonna go blind at the end of this? Who cares? I'm in good company. You know what I mean? Like, it's
with a Rolling Rock.
You don't need to see your friends. You can just sense them. Fucking hell.
I tried to bring this conversation seriously back, but all that Rolling Rock, I couldn't get the Rolling Rock out of my brain during the first bit. And then when we went back to America, to the hometown, I was just like, there's Rolling Rock all at Michael's party, all on the back bar.
Here's a pleasant thought. Right at this moment, in the rolling green highlands of Pennsylvania's Laurel Mountains, a delightful beer is being brewed for your enjoyment. The name of the beer is Rolling Rock, the beer that's better because it's brewed from mountain spring water. At the Rolling Rock Brewery, the sights and sounds of nature are plentiful. From the cool pleasantness of the mountain air to the sparkling quality of the mountain spring water. There, under the watchful eyes of skilled brewmasters, Rolling Rock is brewed slowly and carefully, then leisurely aged. Ask for a bottle of Rolling Rock beer at your favorite tavern. And to enjoy it at home, you can order it by the case from your neighborhood dealer. Although Rolling Rock is best known for its small 7-ounce green pony bottle, if you prefer the larger size, you can also buy it in 12-ounce bottles and cans.
Dude, the first sequence, the first Russian roulette sequence, I love it. That's the essence of De Niro when he's got that fucking, you motherfucker. I love it.
Go ahead, Nikki. Go ahead. Just do it. Do it. Go ahead.
I love one of the prerequisites from that thing. They had to hire somebody who hated Americans to slap De Niro in the face.
You're joking?
Yeah, because nobody else would do it.
Yeah, there was.
I don't think it was hard to find someone hating Americans in Vietnam.
No, because they were.
They were in Thailand. So.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go.
Were they in Thailand?
Yeah.
Yeah, they filmed in Thailand. The first guy that they got, they didn't think the slaps were believable or hard enough. So, yeah, they tried to find somebody who hated Americans, and every slap you
feel. Oh, De Niro takes a real slap there.
Yeah, even Christopher Walken. The first couple of slaps Christopher Walken takes is proper, like, he is, like...
I'm going to tell you something. People don't get slapped anymore like they used to in the movies.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
It was a different time.
Yeah. They slapped method out of this, you know, milquetoast kids today.
Method acting has been demonized.
It's been demonized. Just not that, you know? One man alone has destroyed the arts, which is...
Jared Leto.
It's Morbid Time!
The way it makes me feel, infection. It's almost like a tongue on the back of my neck. And if I had a choice, connection, I never had a chance to catch my breath. It's eating up the space between us. It's eating up all remaining doubt. It's filling up the hole inside you. It's trying to find a way.
Should we talk about the technical side of it? When the movie opened, I had nothing as a frame of reference, right? So I was surprised by something, but there's no way, shape, or form that this would have surprised me when I watched it the first time. I didn't remember. But from the opening, there's a very fluid shot of a tunnel. You know, it's like we are entering. What is it based? Is it somewhere in, is it, it's not Michigan. What is it?
It's in Pennsylvania.
It's Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And it's like we are crossing a threshold into this world, right? Into this town, which it seems to me that everyone that lives there, even their accommodation, there's always where they work is in the background. Like everyone in this town, you know, sustenance is provided by steel mill or whatever the fuck it is. And everyone that lives there works there. And it's very believable. It's a presence. It's always there. It's in the middle. It's like a tumor. And it's this industrial feel of this place, that's where the revisionism comes in, because there's so much emotion around this very like industrialized and soulless kind of environment, right? But these people feel, these people live. That's why the wedding is so important, because you see them just letting everything out, you know. And yes, they drink a lot, man. Like, the movie opens with them drinking before the wedding, then drinking at the wedding, then drinking. So they're constantly drunk. And you'll kind of pick up on the fact that the only way to deal was to drink, right? But it's there's a stark contrast. The only character that brings it back to reality with you know, the roughness of it all is Cazal. Cazal's character, when he punches that woman, I mean, it comes from nowhere. But you see, there's, you know, there's the father, Meryl Streep father, hitting her at the beginning as well. It's like generational kind of poison, you know, alcoholism running rampant, because it's the only way to, you know, to deal with this life, the pace of
but
this life.
It's the intro scene, the intro hour, whatever you want to call it, the 45
minutes. Shot, by the way.
Yeah. It's representing the American dream, the American staple, the capitalist monster, or whatever you want to call it, because what it's trying to show you is what normality is to an American, and what normality was to an American during the 60s at the time. And the normality was that they're small towns. They don't know much about the world. They don't know much about what's, you know, anything that they know about is what they can drive to within about 20 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
And that's it.
But that happens in many parts of the world, you could argue, right?
Which is why it's so great that the juxtaposition of him going deer hunting and shooting that deer to suddenly being in the middle of a village in wherever it is, or the very cusp.
The culture shock you're talking about.
Yeah.
A young person, yeah. Which, by the way, that message kind of gets lost. It works against the movie to have the cast not being that age. Because, fuck, man, they do act 20. They act 20 really well in this, like almost 20, you know, early, like, what's it called? It's not after teenagehood. What's there?
It's just early 20s, isn't it? Early young adultness.
Well, yeah, they acted to the T. They act young. But the thing is, that these are grown men, and all of them, I guess there's uniformity in that because all of them are like 10 to 12 to 15 years older than the age they're acting. It's a thing about this movie, man. It affected the reception, the critical reception of this movie.
But they also, like, all hats off to the actors. They did need to have experienced actors because they became gaunt for the Vietnam scenes. They became like almost skeletal structures of their facial features. Like, you think about Christopher Walken, he is quite skeletal in his facial features. He looked so, like, those scenes under the hut where he's like drenched in water and like being eaten alive by mosquitoes, he's gaunt.
Yeah, so quite literally he survived on nothing but water, rice and bananas.
So I mean,
that's look.
But what I'm so, but we go from the deer hunting scene to what it was like to be in Vietnam, and the fact that there's a scene early on where a Viet Cong officer walks into the village, sees the whole village in a hiding place, and just throws a grenade in there and closes it, and boom. And then, like, the mum carrying a child, and she gets mowed down as well, which gives Robert De Niro's Michael character the opportunity to gun him down. It's just dog eat dog.
Man, that's, you know what? Cimino did this, like, he made it look effortless. There's the moment in which we'll see it looks like, you know, they're winning, whatever, and all you need is that shot of them coming out of the fucking woods.
Yeah.
And then the next one is the prisoners. And you know, it doesn't hold your hand. It doesn't feel disjointed. That sequence is great. Also, myself and Steve, all the way through this, it's like stock footage, stock footage, stock footage.
Yeah.
But it's perfectly placed.
Mm.
You know, like it's...
You know, the scene with a rat, when the character...
No, I'm Steve's thinking about Nicolas Cage in The Surfer again.
Man, he ruins
But go on, the scene with the rat, well, the
When Stevie, well, the character Stevie's screaming, Michael, there's a rat in here. Michael, there's a rat in here. He's actually not saying Mikey. He's saying Michael. It's, and you know, he's putting it towards the director. So it's like,
oh, really? There you go. Yeah. Oh, you think that he was addressing Cimino?
Yeah.
And he kept that in. That's amazing.
It's one of the set stories.
I gotta say that, like, what happens to Stevie is it has to be parodied in a thousand. Like, even in the Naked Gun series or whatever. You know, when someone gets hurt and then it gets hurt and then it gets hurt and then it gets hurt. By the end of the film, he's fucking legless.
Literally. It did get parodied in things like The Naked Gun, because doesn't O.J. Simpson's character in the second Naked Gun film
with the opening of The Naked Gun, right?
And all gets flipped into, because he's always getting hurt.
And yet survives through it all. That's fucking...
I don't think, a big, you know, hat off to John Savage. Am I right, John Savage?
John Savage.
I don't think I've ever seen anybody so realistically in absolute shock and terror on
God, every time the gun cocks, he has a reaction, but then he has that really emotional reaction, the panic. And hey, man, I know this for a fact. It has to be. The audio mix, I bet you that the sound those guns made when they fire dry. Fire dry? Is that what? No, when they dry fired? Dry fired? Is that what? Even the thing?
Yep.
Hey, gun expert.
So
how do you say that?
So they're dry fired, as in the click, no bullet inside it.
That's fucking technical. Saying, yeah, I know, but is dry firing an expression?
Yeah.
Well, it'd be.
It is now. Yeah. Is it?
It's a. I don't know. It's shooting blanks, maybe.
I tell you, you have that story. Book I gave you. The book will have the fucking definition of dry firing. Anyway, every single
bullets in it. So that's it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the idea is that every time, what's that part of the gun called?
The cock.
The hammer.
Hammer and cock. Sorry.
Yeah.
The hammer. That's right. Cock. The hammer.
Cock. Yeah.
Cypress Hill track, amazing. Put it in. Okay. Cock the hammer.
I'm a chicken hawk, hunting for a chicken. Get paranoid when you hear my Glock clicking. Speaking to the punk, that's freaking with your bitch hair style. I hit you like chicken. Jones house call for Dr. Bones. I'll roll you up and smoke you like cones. Split the seed and grow you like clones. Don't stomp me up, cause I'm not the Rolling Stone. But I get stoned with a little help from my friends with the gun blend. Then I pass around back to I can make you famous like Amos, same as the last punk when I stuck the gap up in Zenus. Hear me growl. I got the night vision like the wise old owl. I'm coming up fetch ya, yeah, home's a witcher. Bury them bones under my home and cock the hammer. Cock the hammer, it's time for action.
Cock the hammer.
It's episode Cock the Hammer. Okay, it's in there. Now, every time you hear that, I remember, we should go and take a look. Before this transfer, all right, the latest transfer, even before DVD maybe, because this movie was released in every format, it was a metallic click. But here, they put a, it's almost unnatural. There's a bass. And every time that happens, the reaction of John Savage is pure fucking panic.
Yeah.
And it's super endearing how De Niro's trying to calm him down in that situation. I said earlier, I think he is the one that carries the burden of all of them. All of them, for whatever reason. But he doesn't do it like he's the fucking hero. He does it like it is essentially a burden. You know, it's... Yeah.
The funny thing is, we were talking about watching this with a juvenile eye. I remember that those scenes I couldn't handle with my juvenile eye. Basically, I started mythologizing what was happening underneath the camera out of frame, because there were certain O faces that John Savage was pulling that you could easily, like, you know, put a wacky 70s thing on. This time, though, I would say, like, his performance is spellbinding.
It's phenomenal.
It is phenomenal. Yeah. And then to have Christopher Walken in the back going through his own trauma, the change of trauma through each person's
They're all
lens.
Worried about different things in this
yeah.
sequence.
And the funny and thing is you have a...
Walken knows he's next.
Yeah. And
that's what's happening there.
The funny thing is you have a fourth guy who you don't even get to know.
That dude, yeah.
Who's just,
the one with the shaved head, right?
He's already been through it because there's a slight scar across his forehead.
Down. Oh, fuck.
Yeah, there's a slight scar across his forehead and he's already been through it, but he is already gone. He is... Again, a Cassandra figure, an oracle figure of, like, what's about to happen to Christopher Walken. The fact that he is not even there. He has displaced himself to another realm almost because he knows there's no way of getting out of it.
You know, the bluff for the plan, right? Because they have the plan. The plan is, I want 3 bullets in that gun because he's counting how many fucking people they need to take out with one gun at least before they go for another weapon. There's the bit when he challenges them with bravado. That's bait. When he goes up and he goes, I'll do it with 3 bullets. That entire sequence is mesmerizing. And yet again, I misremembered most of this movie, but I placed that at the end of the movie because there is another sequence at the end of the movie that it's like the grandiose kind of. And that shot, that's almost Kubrick, by the way it's lit, that sequence, because everyone's clear. Like, it's like you have an audience, it's like an amphitheater kind of thing. There are different levels as well, which is weird because that's not how a room works. If you pay attention to that shot, there are people at different levels. What are they doing? Are they standing on chairs? Like, it's weird. It's so well constructed. It's in fact, it's one of the posters for this theatrical as well had that sequence in it, you know, hyper stylized and black and white or whatever. I think that's the one that is on your version Ricky, isn't it?
Yeah, so I don't have the original poster, which is taken from the scene we're talking about currently, but it is exactly what you described it as. It's one of the later scenes where they're surrounded by people and they're sitting opposite ends of a table while
the guy with the fucking while a
showman, a masters of ceremony, yeah, is conducting what is going to happen next.
Dressed as that guy for Halloween, dude.
Yeah, it's just
no.
So they get out of, and it's a spellbinding scene, but they get out of it only for the scene to extend itself with them escaping on a log. And that scene is, as much as everyone complains about how long the wedding scene is, that scene's excruciating. And again, it's do you know the reason?
Who busses out?
Yeah.
Passes out, and I had to say to Steve, why is he passing out? He goes, the nutrition. I was like, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. It's a heavy watch.
One of the heaviest scenes I find is actually later on, which is where Christopher Walken gets asked, can you tell me what your parents' names are, what their first names are? And he just can't label anything. He's got no memory of his earlier life, and he can't label anything. Rolling back a bit, there were so many production problems with them just getting onto the helicopter. And, you know, there's stories of how many times they had to fall into the water, and there was actually the actors. There was no stuntmen for this scene. The fact that the helicopter had caught...
What do you mean there was no stuntmen?
There's no stuntmen.
There's no stuntmen.
That's John Savage and De Niro?
De Niro falling into the water several times.
John Savage actually injured himself... He dislocated
his leg. Oh, he fucking did in the movie.
He dislocated his leg falling into that river.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And the helicopter, they didn't realize, because of how much they were shooting, the helicopter pilot was starting to lose feeling in his foot. So they didn't realize how lopsided the helicopter was. And so if you look carefully...
What, from using the rudder too much?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, his foot kind of fell asleep. And you can actually see it in the footage of the film. The you know the leg bars that they sit on?
Yeah, and like
one of them hooks
the landing,
up on
the landing gear, right?
Yeah, one of them actually hooks up on the bridge. And you can see it. It's like hooked up on the bridge, and you can see the bridge like being pulled up while the helicopter is trying to pull away. And it actually took the director to like kind of climb down and unhook the bridge before the cable got like caught up in the rotor or something. Oh, it's just crazy how much. And again, different time and them just shooting on a budget or whatever. There's also.
Yeah, but then you make fucking magic, dude. But you make it's magic.
It's not just that. All the audio was filmed on location as well, which is fantastic. There's no studio sound.
Even on the where they were escaping, supposedly you can hear the directors like drowning at one point because one of the boats hits the director while they're filming the log spinning, which the log wasn't meant to spin, but you know, you can't control the currents. And one of the boats hits him, so you can actually hear like a drowning sound, which they then covered by having John Savage character, whenever he dipped under, that was actually the director like gurgling and blah blah blah. It's such a crazy mismatch of scenes that shouldn't have worked. And again, there's something magical in a weird way about these Vietnam films around this time, because it all comes together in their editing. Because at the time, the directors are like, oh God, we've ruined that shot, or oh, that doesn't make sense, or oh, this was all we could catch, or one of the canisters has gotten exposed while we've been out in the Thailand sun or whatever. And it's incredible that they actually managed to piece a lot of this together.
Hats off to the entire team who worked on the production of this. I mean, corners were cut in some places, especially with what Umba said earlier as well, with stock footage being used and stuff. But my God, I mean, it's beautifully directed.
Mm.
And it's raw. It feels raw.
I would like to know, it does feel raw, but I also get a sense that I need to, I'm not familiar. I'm familiar with Cimino's work, but I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of how he works. And now I'm interested, because one thing that I sensed here, it seems to me that he lets actors act.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm interested in knowing what directorial style he has. I think he lets them roll.
So
he lets them go with what they want to do.
You know, the entire sequence for the for Russian Roulette wasn't in the original script.
What do you mean?
They didn't have, in the entire original script, there was no Russian Roulette. It was a last minute thing. And they did it twice. But it's not just that. I watched a documentary about this movie with Michael Cimino in it. And he's stating, like, most of the actual sets, most of it was raw and live. So the wedding scene is 5 days worth of people drinking and getting on with each other. Most of it's unscripted.
And so it's all shot on location as well, somehow, right?
Shot on location. Yeah. The sound mix is the sound mix that you actually hear. So
I don't think there's a single soundstage as well in this.
There's no soundstage. No, no extra work.
You can't fucking do that today, you know?
No.
It's impossible.
So a lot of this is unscripted work.
Meryl Streep's character, because you don't see Linda for a good chunk of the film. You see her at the very start for the first hour, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever. And then you see her for like maybe 40 minutes of the last hour of the 3 hours.
She's mischievous in this. She's quite mischievous.
But Meryl Streep's, like, her character arc is beautiful. From someone who is trying to escape a life to someone who's basically running her own life to someone who is just saddened because nothing ever seems to work out for her. It's beautiful. And even that scene where they go to the motel and she's like, oh, isn't it really funny, Michael, me and you? Oh, I can't believe tonight's happening. And tonight isn't happening because Michael is exhausted.
The use of mirrors in this movie is phenomenal.
So fantastic.
Yeah, the camera goes around this. I mean, you're introduced into the sequence via the mirror, and it takes a while before you realize it's a mirror. Like, there's two of them.
Yeah.
The one with the father at the beginning. But hey, I think Linda, is that her name?
Yeah,
the character that she plays. She reminded me a lot of Etta, the dynamic that Etta had with Butch and Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Because she loves both of them, right? And it's the same thing here. She loves both of them.
Apart from, Michael is a creep at the start of this film. Michael's akin with Stan on creep level.
What do you mean?
Like, there's that scene by the bar where he's getting a little too handsy with Linda, and Linda finally goes, oh, Nick, I'm really glad you're here.
Oh, yeah, when he almost leans in, right?
Yeah.
And he stops. But before that, there's something that actually, and it's a weird thing because it's, you blink and you miss it. When Linda comes to the trailer, because obviously they share that accommodation, you know, Stephen and Michael live together. Nikki and Michael live together, right? And she comes in. As she's coming in, he exits through the other door. And she's disappointed. It's very brief, but she's disappointed that he didn't say goodbye. So it just leaves like, I don't want to say this now. So you're kind of told that he has a thing for her just from that reaction.
It's also a clue to, like, maybe there was, you know, some sort of misunderstanding, some sort of almost, let's be honest. I don't think Michael's a likable person at the start of this film. Yeah.
Again, put younger actors in it, and all of a sudden this is much lighter. That's what I'm saying. I think Cimino's a genius. He wasn't forced to do this. He could have picked younger actors that fit that age. Somehow all these emotions feel like it's not cheating. It's adultery. Do you understand?
Yeah.
like what I'm saying, it's like it's like a weird play where you get older people to play younger people. It's not just a coincidence because you wanted every single member of the cast is 10 to 15 years older than their age, and yet they act so that it's another layer. I can't mention any other movie where this happens.
But you know what the true controversy around this film was? The true controversy around this film was the fact that a lot of people said it's untruth, it's historically inaccurate. And what? by that they mean like the inclusion of the Russian roulette scene, the way the Vietnam's portrayed.
People were quite upset about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a very, most people just called it racist and they called it over misogynistic and whatnot. Mm. But it also shows you why the Oscar system is broken, because this almost...
You're talking about the Academy Awards. Yes. The latest movie received.
Yes.
Didn't it win a bunch of shit?
It did. It was the winner. It was the winner of 1979.
It was definitely, I think it was 11 Academy Awards.
Yeah, so Best Director, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting
Nominations
Actress.
Or it won?
It won. It won a
lot. Do you mean it won Best Director?
Yeah.
Well, and Best Supporting Actor was with Walken.
So why are you saying that the Academy Awards system was broken?
Because it was meant to have an earlier release. So from my knowledge, most of the principal filming was in 77. They had a rough cut at the start of 78, and all the producers or new ones producers of whoever was distributing it watched it, and from the moment the deer got killed, they were like, you can't sell this film to anyone. Oh, the deer's dead. Like, no one's going to watch this. So what he did was say, you know what, we'll do two test screenings. We'll do a heavily cut one and one with the three-hour cut that I want to release. He got the projectionist at the shorter one to, slow the film down, burn up the film halfway through the film. So it got to the end of the wedding scene, burned up the film. Everyone had to exit the theater, come back in, watch the last hour and a hour, I think it was, and nobody liked it because they couldn't match up the start of the film to the end of the film. The three-hour cut got so much praise that that's the one they had to release. But then they delayed the film because they didn't have any... They thought to themselves, how are we going to sell this? This is a Vietnam film that hates Vietnam. We can't sell it, but... So they showed it to a choice select critic group who then gave it praise. They then showed it to cinephiles. They purposely said cinephiles. We've shown it to cinephiles who love cinema. And they wrote
those
reviews.
Those people are fuckheads, right?
I know. It's like they're like screen divers, I guess. That's another nickname for them. But that got them the Academy nominations. And then they did the bigger, wider release in December.
Well done, dude. You circled back. Well done.
Yeah. So the point
is... You took 20 minutes to get me to understand a basic concept, doesn't it?
But my point is that this film could have died a very handsome death like many other great films. But instead, the controversy of the way they played the market... actually had people like Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
There we go. That's how you say his name. Warren Beatty to hate the film and others because they were like, you're stopping Heaven Can Wait from getting an Oscar. You're stopping this film from getting an Oscar. And, my point is that they played the Hollywood system and that's how they got Oscars for this film, which... You know, it could have easily, a lot of people consider this the Green Book of its year, a film about why did this get...
I actually like the Green Book, dude.
I didn't.
It's exploitative, but the performances I like the performances in it. But yeah, I didn't read the book. Did you read the book?
I didn't, but also it glosses over how homosexuals were treated during that era as well. Literally only one scene and that's it. Anyway... So we've dealt with a lot of the Vietnam era, but have we? Yes, we have. I'm going to say we have, because there's so much intense within that era. However, the last hour when Michael goes back home to face his reality, his original existence, is very akin to something like the Hurt Locker. And that blinding scene in the Hurt Locker where he finally goes home and he can't handle it. And you don't actually question why he goes back to Vietnam to find Nick. Even though it's very heavy-handed, like, here's a bunch of money that Nick has been sending all the time to Steve. So Nick's still alive. I've got to go find Nick. But actually, you don't question it because he's so uncomfortable with his older existence.
Yeah, true. I mean, the entire concept of PTSD is approached in a very... He tiptoes around it very, very, very well. I was looking for, just out of interest, because you mentioned Heaven's Gate, which is, you know, I think it's 2 years after this or whatever, so it probably is next movie. But I possibly have seen this in the video store, and now we're going to have to do it at some point. And it's recorded, so we'll promise to ourselves that we'll do it. He made a movie, I think in 87 or whatever the fuck it says here, called The Sicilian, with Christopher Lambert. We need to watch this. John Turturro, Terrence Stamp. Are you fucking kidding me? Look at it. The Sicilian. We're doing this. We are doing this. And the tagline for the movie goes, before the Godfather, there was the Sicilian. I just need to hear Christopher Lambert doing an Italian accent here. It's written by Mario Puzo. Mate, is this a prequel to The Godfather?
Might be.
Might be.
No. It's written by Mario Puzo and Gore Vidal.
It says, the novel is a spin-off of The Godfather, set during Michael's exile in Sicily.
No. Did you know that it was a prequel? I'm excited now.
I'm not. Oh, there's two versions of it. There's an original cut of 150 minutes and a director's cut of 146 minutes.
We must suffer for the arts. I think it's time for ratings times.
It's an 8 for me. Stan's revolvers. 8 Stan's revolvers, but one which he hands in the back of his pants. So
the stub nose.
Yeah, it's a Smith & Wesson Model 10. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. It's got a little 2-inch barrel.
Nice one. Nice one. Would you recommend this movie, Steve? Would you?
I do recommend this movie, but it's not for faint-hearted. Mm. Because it's not a typical Vietnam movie. It's a solid movie with great direction, great audio, and a fantastic cast. I mean, just the cast itself is freaking ridiculous, and some outstanding performances. I mean, it's just crazily well done.
Cool. Ricky,
for me, this is a 9.8. I love this film. I turned this on the other day. I knew I had to watch it in two sittings because of its length and because of my day job.
But you see, I'm like, I plead with our listeners not to do a fragmented watch. I think it's harder if, you know, you've seen it before, but this requires a consecutive watch.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're tired,
definitely.
Don't turn it on.
Look, I would normally...
Don't go to the wedding.
But my point is, is that even when I turned it on and I knew that I had to watch it in two sittings, I was enthralled. There was no part of me not enthralled with this. I have found it very difficult reading reviews where people have said, oh, why won't the first bit go over quickly? This is a great film. This is an amazing film. This is a staple film. This is a film that will always, forever, in my head, be part of the top 10. Easy. What is it, a 9.8 for? It's a 9.8. Michael don't share his boots when he goes on a deer hunt.
This movie is, I think I'm gonna be where Steve went. It's an 8. I came into this with an 8, actually. And an 8 is very high, by the way.
Yeah.
Why is it an 8? It's an 8 because I wish there was something that this movie didn't introduce, but it has that feel. I kept thinking about Once Upon a Time in America. I think it's a very, very strong parallel. And it needs to be mentioned here because it's about friendship. this movie would have benefited from playing with time a little bit. Perhaps the reason, a place for anything but linearity when it comes down to the storytelling here. But this movie does something masterfully. You're invited to a wedding and you need to go. You are there and you know how close you are to these people. And there's no other movie that does that, you know. But it's an invitation, just like an invitation to a wedding, that you need to accept. And this is a plea to our listeners. Accept this invitation. Go to this wedding. Meet these people. And you'll feel stuff. Yeah? It's an 8. It's an 8 Rolling Rocks. For sure.
And on that note,
this was Umba.
This is Steve.
And this is Ricky.
Too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.